Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
911.
Hey! Please get someone to my office. 4700 truck, please.
What's going on?
Please, my girlfriend. I think she just shot herself in blood everywhere. Please.
Your daughter killed herself. She committed suicide.
I said, this is There's no way that Michelle would ever take her life.
This is just a sheriff that's out of control and a situation that was mishandled. And then at the root of it, a family that suffers because of egos and power. I mean, the word suicide was thrown around right off the bat without any investigation.
And I screamed and yelled at the top of my lungs, we want an outside investigation.
I think Jeremy killed her.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
I'm Lauren.
I am Ken.
And this is Paradise After Dark.
Dark, dark, dark.
Paradise After Dark is an independent podcast covering true crime,
unsolved mysteries,
missing people,
and urban legends.
If you'd like to support our show and get a bunch of extra Paradise After Dark content, including early and ad-free episodes, please sign up for our Patreon at patreon.com/palmahawkmedia. That's PALMAHAWK Media.
And please check out our website, paradiseafterdark.com.
On our website, you'll find links to all of our episodes, even the archived ones, which, by the way, as of now, all of our episodes from 2019 and older are only available on our website. You'll also find on our website our mailing list, merch store, links to our social medias, and of course, our Patreon.
We also have a virtual tip jar, so leave us a tip and we'll give you a shout out on the show. Kind of like Michael from Chicago. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Michael. We also have Brandon from Macon, Georgia.
Macon, Georgia.
Thank you, Brandon. And we actually have one more, Ashley from Florida. Not sure where in Florida, but she's from Florida.
Ashley, let us know where you're from.
Yeah.
Florida's huge.
It's all good.
Thank you very much, Ashley. Okay, so Lauren, tonight, this is a little bit of a mysterious case this evening.
It's a complicated case,
and
I
yet
would say.
Still mysterious.
Yeah, well,
so
yeah.
I was right. You can't say I'm wrong. I was right.
No, I'm not saying it's mysterious and complicated.
Yes, very much so. So why don't you go ahead and
just dive right in? Tonight we are going to be discussing the case of Michelle O'Connell. Shortly before midnight on September 2nd, 2010, Jeremy Banks, then a 23-year-old deputy with the St. Johns County Sheriff's Department in St. Augustine, Florida, called 911 to report his girlfriend, Michelle O'Connell, 24, had shot and killed herself. Michelle was a doting mother of a 4-year-old girl, Alexis, aka Lexi. At the time of her death, it appeared as if she was finally in a really good place. After a life of many ups and downs, she had just landed her dream job at a daycare center and had high hopes for an independent future. The job was full-time, paid well, and offered benefits. Best of all, she could bring Lexi to work with her. As a single mom, she sometimes worked up to 3 jobs at a time to make ends meet for herself and her daughter. So this new career opportunity was a really big deal. Michelle grew up in St. Augustine, the youngest of six kids raised in a small cramped apartment by her single mom, Patty. By her early teenage years, she began doing poorly in school and rebelling. When she was 15, she was taken into custody after a fight with her brother. The police were called to the O'Connell apartment again the next year after she fought with her sister. But with medication and counseling for what juvenile records described as anger problems and depression, Michelle turned herself around. Her schoolwork and attitude improved profoundly, earning praise and enthusiastic support from juvenile authorities and clearing the way for her to work part-time caring for children, which was her passion. When she was 20 years old, she had Lexi, and Lexi became her world.
Well, on Michelle's last day alive, she had lunch with her sister, Chrissy O'Connell. Now, Michelle confided in her sister that she wanted to break up with Jeremy Banks that evening. She told Chrissy that they had planned to go to a concert that evening and she expected there to be trouble. So she's already forecasting a little bit. She said there's going to be a fight because he's going to want me to go out after the concert, Chrissy O'Connell told ABC News. And I said, don't even go to the concert because I knew Jeremy was rageful. I knew in my heart something was going to happen. Michelle's family says that there had been whispers about verbal and physical abuse within the relationship from both sides. But Michelle told Chrissy she was going because she had already paid for the tickets and that she was going to leave Banks. So I'm going to leave him, but we've already paid for the tickets. We're going to go tonight.
And we're going to go to the concert first, and then she was going to leave.
Tonight's the night it's going to happen.
So that evening, Michelle, Jeremy Banks, and her brother Sean O'Connell attended the Paramore concert at the St. Augustine Amphitheater.
Now, I read somewhere that Sean actually introduced the two, or was it another one of her brothers? I know that she was introduced to Jeremy via one of her brothers.
Well, Sean was actually also a deputy with the St. Johns County Sheriff's Office.
Okay, so then maybe that's where I'm getting that from, but I believe that he introduced them together, so I think that may be why they went out that night.
Sean O'Connell said Banks was kind of withdrawn during the show. I was like, hey, do you mind scooting over if you're not going to have fun at the concert with my sister? I'm definitely going to, Sean recalled. Banks later told detectives that he and Michelle had argued before, during, and after the show. We don't get along. We fight all the time. I mean, it's never bad fighting. It's just always arguing, Banks was recorded saying in an interview with St. Johns County Sheriff's Office detectives. Chrissy, her other sister, was babysitting her daughter Alexis while they were at the concert, and she began receiving strange text messages from Michelle during the show. Promise me one thing, Lexi will be happy and always have a good life. That no matter what, Lexi will always be safe and loved. Chrissy was obviously confused and concerned by these messages, but by the time the concert was over, Michelle texted her sister, I'll be there soon, but she never showed up.
So she was receiving text messages from her sister, and that's from her sister's phone. We don't know if they were from the sister, but we know that they were from her
phone. We don't know if they were from Michelle, but they were coming from Michelle's phone.
Yeah,
and they were kind of like strange, like promise me Lexi will always be happy and have a good life. It was definitely strange.
Well, Banks did tell detectives that on the way home from the concert, she said, I'll have my things out by this weekend. And I said, are we breaking up? She said, yes. And I was like, all right. And I raised my voice. She raised her voice. We argued, but when we got to the house, we were fine. Now, this is what he told in an interview with detectives. And according to Banks, Michelle was inside the house while he remained outside with two other friends. I believe they were in the garage hanging out with these other two friends. And at one point, Michelle O'Connell went outside to retrieve a makeup bag from the car and quickly returned back inside. And after 10 to 20 minutes, Banks said his friends left and he sat alone in the garage when he heard a popping sound. I knew exactly what it was. Just instinct, I said, shit. And I ran inside. I started screaming her name. The bedroom door was locked and I screamed her name again, Banks told detectives. I heard it go off again a second time. I ran into the living room. I grabbed the phone. I kicked the bedroom door in and I found her laying where she is. Now, this is what he tells detectives as they show up on the scene after he's called 911.
So Deborah Maynard, a former St. Johns County Sheriff's deputy, was one of the first to arrive on the scene. The call came out, Signal 18, shot fired, possibly one of our own, Maynard recalled to the New York Times. When you hear it's one of your own, adrenaline's pumping. At 11:25 p.m., Maynard and two other St. Johns County officers arrived at 4700 Sherlock Place, a one-story suburban home in the historic Seaside community. A young deputy, Jonathan Hawley, was already there. "Oh my God," he cried, seeing a young woman he knew laying on the bedroom floor, an inert, bloody mess. Michelle was dying from a gunshot to the mouth. Next to her was a semi-automatic pistol that belonged to Banks. A second bullet had burrowed into the carpet by her right arm. Maynard quickly questioned what she was hearing at the scene. Immediately, it was almost like they were taking Jeremy's word that she shot herself at that point, Maynard told ABC News. "We were told it was a suicide. They automatically said it was a suicide, though we are trained to say every scene is a homicide until proven otherwise. But they did immediately start calling it a suicide." Maynard quickly escorted Banks, who had been drinking, out of the house. "All of a sudden, he started growling like an animal," she said. "With his fists, he pounded dents on the hood of her police car. I grabbed him, turned him around." Another deputy, Wesley Grizzard, recalled. "I told him, I don't care if you're intoxicated or not. You better sober up."
Sergeant Scott Beaver, who was also early to arrive on the scene, said, "When I first walked into that room, the first thought went through my head was, this is not good for Jeremy. I was in the homicide unit for a few years and it didn't add up, but I didn't do more investigation into this." Now, Crystal Lynn Cuzort, a paramedic who arrived on the scene, told New York Times, "I remember looking around and seeing little kid stuff and pictures. Not that it's out of the ordinary for anyone to commit suicide. We know that, but it is not common that a girl that age, 23, 24 years old, however old she was, but to have a young child and to commit suicide. She was a really pretty girl and it looked like she was well taken care of," she said. "She just didn't fit the picture of a typical suicide." And 23 minutes after the police arrived, Miss O'Connell was pronounced dead. So at this point, 23 minutes after the police show up, we got the 911 call and they've obviously showed up and she's dead on arrival, or dead on the scene, I should say, rather. And within minutes of the shooting, Banks' friends, family, and even off-duty colleagues began showing up to offer Banks their support. Now, he huddled in a police car with his stepfather, also a deputy sheriff, but from another county, while his colleagues processed the scene. Please note that I use this term "process the scene" lightly. Okay, so now Banks was interviewed right there inside the police car, and we have the audio of the interview.
We have some of the audio of that interview, which we'll play for you now.
I just want to say before we play this clip, we got this interview. Now, keep in mind, these are all deputies. Now, he's 23 years old. I can't believe he's been a deputy for a very long time. So I think a lot of what's happening in this case has a lot to do with maybe his father, and that they're a law enforcement family, and that's a pretty tight-knit community. So now let's go ahead and listen to the clip real quick.
All right, this is Detective Himes. It is officially September 3rd at 1:23 in the morning.
You were outside in the yard driveway.
My motorcycle was in the garage. I was sitting on it with my head down, and I heard it pop, and I knew exactly what it was. And I ran inside. I started screaming her name. The bedroom door was locked, and I screamed her name again. I heard it go off again for the second time.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, so before we go any further, let's dive into the crime scene here. Michelle was found lying on her back in a bedroom, arms out to her sides and her knees slightly bent. The gun, Jeremy Banks' service weapon, a Heckler and Koch 45 caliber pistol, was on the ground just inches from her left hand. Michelle was right-handed, So this suggested that she would have used her weaker hand to shoot herself.
Hmm.
The gun's tactical searchlight attached to the barrel was on. Officers also found two empty pill bottles belonging to Banks, visible in Michelle's open purse. Pills from those bottles were found in her jeans pockets. And Tess later found alcohol, but no traces of pills in her system.
Okay, hold on a second. So these pills that were in the pill bottle belonged to Jeremy, but they were in her purse.
The pill bottles were in her purse. The pills were in her pocket.
Okay.
But there was no sign of any.
So there was no open pill bottles, and there was no pill bottles in the blood or any of that kind of stuff.
No.
Okay.
No.
They also did find out that when they did test on it, that there was none of her DNA were actually on the pill bottles that they found in her purse.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they did test on it and found out that, I mean, there was no fingerprints.
No touch DNA. Exactly.
There's
nothing.
None of that stuff that was found on the pill bottles.
But they were in her purse.
They were in her purse. Just a little tidbit of this crime.
Strange.
Yeah.
So there was a bleeding cut above Michelle's right eye. A possible sign of a violent struggle before the fatal shot. The gun was in Banks' duty belt, and Michelle would have had to pull the gun from its retention holster, designed to make it difficult for an unauthorized person, particularly one unfamiliar with guns, to withdraw the weapon. No one in Michelle's family believed that she died by suicide. Actually, there's some facts that indicate that she had no intention whatsoever of ending her life. Aside from the fact that she was ecstatic about her new job, she had texted her sister, who was babysitting her daughter on that night, "I'll be there soon." She had made plans for the following day to go to breakfast with her mother. In her appointment book, which was found in her car, she had signed up for CPR training for 2 days after her death.
So they're saying that this was the spur of the moment suicide.
Possibly. And friends and family also say that she would never leave her daughter.
Understandable.
But, you know, things happen in, like you said, like the heat of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Spur
of the moment kind of a suicide.
But it doesn't look like she had any plans on ending her life.
And from her conversation that she had with her sister when they were at lunch the previous day, or was it that day?
It was that day.
Earlier that day, she was going to leave him, and they were going out to this concert, but she was going to leave him. So there's no mention of anything other than, you know, I know there's going to be trouble, but this is what I'm going to do. So she had a mindset of, I'm leaving and I'm basically starting a new life. I'm leaving and doing this over somewhere else.
Right.
But sadly, the O'Connell family was never given a chance to voice their concerns on this matter. I mean, Michelle O'Connell's siblings were outraged when they realized that the sheriff's office had spent only a few hours investigating before calling her death a suicide, which was noted by others on the crime scene as well. Now, the word suicide was thrown around right off the bat without any investigation, her sister Chrissy O'Connell told 2020. Now, 2 days after her death, Dr. Frederick Hoban, who was the medical examiner at the time, officially ruled O'Connell's death a suicide. Despite the family's initial efforts to have local authorities enlist an outside agency to investigate her death, St. Johns County Sheriff David Shore told them he would not be doing that.
See, that's a little – that's odd in itself, because if there is ever a situation that involves a deputy from a certain agency, there is always supposed to be a different agency brought in to investigate, whether that be FDLE or a neighboring county sheriff's department. But it is very, I can't think of exactly the right word for it. It's not like unethical,
yeah.
But it's just not right for an agency to investigate one of their own. Just what comes to mind right now, way back when we did the case of missing Terrence Williams and Felipe Santos, both of them were last seen with a Collier County deputy.
Yeah.
And they had FDLE come in to do that investigation. They did not have Collier County investigate one of their own.
Correct. Well, that makes perfect sense.
But here we have the sheriff saying that they would not be bringing in another agency to do this investigation.
Well, exactly. And Sheriff David Shore would later acknowledge that his department made missteps in how the investigation was handled. including that his deputies failed to canvass the neighborhood for witnesses. They failed to interview Michelle's family members and failed to isolate, interview, and photograph Banks in a structured environment. So
they just talked to him inside a police car.
Exactly. So he admitted that they made, you know, some mistakes, but I agree with you 100%. I don't think it was right for them to maintain their own investigation.
Family also alleged that Michelle was scared of Banks and she was the victim of domestic abuse in the months leading up to her death, according to the Times. Domestic abuse is believed to be the most frequently unreported crime, and it is particularly corrosive when it involves the police. Interviews and documents show police departments all over the country have been slow to recognize and discipline abusers in uniform, largely because of a predominantly male blue wall of silence. Victims are often reluctant to file complaints, fearing that an officer's colleagues simply will not listen or understand, or that if they do, the abuser may be stripped of his weapon and ultimately his family's livelihood. The model rules issued by the International Association of Chiefs of Police insist on zero tolerance for abusers and urge departments to begin formal investigations of all complaints immediately.
Yeah, we're not trying to bash law enforcement at all or St. John's County Sheriff's Office, but in this case, things probably should have been handled a little bit differently.
According to the New York Times, in St. John's County, a review of records found three cases in recent years in which sheriff's officers failed to open immediate investigations of domestic abuse reports involving their colleagues. 2 years before Michelle's death, supervisors learned of accusations of domestic abuse against an officer, but followed up aggressively only after his frightened wife fled the house naked, clutching her child, and called authorities. Dismissal was recommended, but the sheriff kept the officer on staff.
Well, not long after Michelle's death, the O'Connell family met later with Lieutenant Bradley, the sheriff's representative. And Christine complained that on the night of the shooting, officers had rebuffed her efforts to tell them what her sister had revealed at lunch the very day Michelle died, as we spoke about earlier. I said, am I allowed to submit a statement? Because she told me a lot of things about, and I'm just going to spell it out for everyone here, domestic violence. She came to my house, said, I'm leaving. I'm scared of this and that. This is what was told to the lieutenant. And in an interview with the Times, Christine recalled that a few months earlier, Michelle called to say she was bleeding vaginally after Banks had shown her, quote, a submissive move during a play wrestling that got out of hand. He slammed me so hard and he put his knee up into my chest, Michelle told her. But Michelle would not let her call an ambulance. She said, please, you're going to make it hard on me. Please, I don't want any trouble. Now, Christine O'Connell said there were other incidents that were unreported as well for fear of causing trouble for Banks and for her relatives who worked at the sheriff's office. Remember, her brother worked as a sheriff's deputy. You know, her boyfriend does. Her boyfriend's father did. Now, on one occasion, two family members said Michelle told them that she had come home to find Banks masturbating to a cell phone picture of a former girlfriend. Then she said he smeared semen on her face and hair. Now, this information was of no use, the police told her, because it was all hearsay. Understandably so. But Banks admitted that about a month before the shooting, during an argument that turned physical, he used, quote, a leg sweep to put her on the ground so she would stop hitting him. Now, this is what he told the FDLE. Now, Banks weighed almost twice as much as Michelle, and, quote, she was afraid of him and Alexis was afraid of him. That's what Christine O'Connell said.
Authorities had been accused of botching the investigation into one of their own from the start. Officers reportedly failed to test key forensic evidence, including the gun and the clothing Banks wore that night, download his cell phone data, or photograph him. Neighbors, family, and friends weren't questioned. It took 4 months, but Shore finally bowed to pressure from the family, knowing that his department's investigation had fallen short.
You know, it was later found that Banks' revolver contained no fingerprints and no DNA on the gun. And there was also some questions. Maybe there wasn't any blood in the gun at all, but yet this was part of the suicide.
Yeah, it had no, there was no, just like the pill bottles, there was no fingerprints, no DNA from either Banks or Michelle O'Connell.
Yeah.
Now, if she had shot herself with that gun, her DNA would have been on that gun.
One would assume. I mean,
And if it was his duty weapon, his DNA would have been on that guy.
Correct. That's what I find to be odd.
So, like I was saying, it took 4 months, but Shore finally bowed to the pressure from the family. He asked state investigators to take a fresh look at the case. Florida Department of Law Enforcement, or FDLE, investigator Rusty Rogers was assigned to the case. In his investigation, he found something that the sheriff's department had not. Two of Banks' neighbors, Stacy Boswell and Heather Ladley, had heard a woman screaming for help from the Banks home. Boswell told the Times that the night of Michelle's death, she heard a man and woman screaming. There was something wrong, Boswell recalled. There was nothing playful, no nothing. It was somebody that was scared. We heard her yell help, and there was one gunshot, and then she yelled help again, and there was a second gunshot. The second witness, Ladley, told Rusty Rogers. It was probably 10, maybe 15 minutes, and then the sirens came, Boswell noted, explaining that's why we didn't call anybody. Rogers also called in a crime scene reconstructionist with 4 decades of experience who performed a field test outside to try and see if Michelle shot herself or was shot by somebody else, based on where the shell casings landed in the test. His conclusion, this was a homicide. Following his investigation, Rogers presented his findings to the medical examiner, Dr. Hoban. According to a recording of an interview with Dr. Hoban by Jacksonville reporter Ann Schindler, Hoban came to believe that Michelle O'Connor's death was, quote, probably a homicide. Hoban filled out an amended death certificate and listed homicide as the manner of death.
So now we've changed.
Right. But Hoban didn't officially file the amended death certificate because he was told to hold off by the state attorney while the investigation continued. Hoban was later reprimanded by the state medical examiner's office for keeping that document and others at his home rather than at the medical examiner's office, essentially hiding them.
Okay.
We'll talk about that in a minute.
Okay.
A new medical examiner, Dr. Predrag Bullock, was then consulted. Bullock believes Michelle O'Connell's death was a suicide. Dr. Bullock was also reprimanded by the state medical examiner's office because of mishandlings in this case.
Huh?
And again, we're going to get to that in a little bit.
Okay. We'll get to that in a little while. We'll circle back. The St. Johns County Sheriff's Office fought back. Now, Sheriff Shore penned a 152-page review of the case, which is mostly positive assessment of his department. He ridiculed the field test over the fact that it was done in an open field and didn't take into account the variables at the scene, such as walls, ceiling, furniture, and Michelle O'Connell's extremities. Banks fought back in the form of filing a lawsuit against the FDLE and Rogers for allegedly violating the civil rights by detaining him for questioning in Michelle's death. And the case dragged on for years. Let's take a quick break.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Well, 5.5 years after Michelle O'Connell's death, her family had her body exhumed and got in touch with Dr. William Anderson, a forensic pathologist and former deputy chief medical examiner for Orange County, Florida. Now, he was asked to examine the original autopsy report and do a second autopsy. Now, while he examined the first autopsy report and then did the second autopsy report, he found that Michelle's jaw was actually broken. Now, news of the fracture brought into question the work of Hoban. Now, he was the original medical examiner who decided it was a good idea to keep the documents at home. Now, Anderson said the fact that it was left out of the autopsy report was very disturbing to him. Because if everything else is very carefully described and you leave out a major finding out of your report, it's not a good practice, Anderson told ABC News of Hoban's omission of the fractured jaw from the original autopsy report. It's significant because the fracture reveals how Michelle O'Connell could have died. Now, the only explanation that I can see that's reasonable is that there was another force, a blow to the chin that broke the mandible prior to the time the gunshot wound was inflicted. Anderson said, in my opinion, it was a homicide. Now, Anderson said, it is possible in some cases that a shot could split the jaw, but he doesn't believe that's the case with Michelle O'Connell based on the evidence he reviewed. Here's the deal. According to Anderson, there was a gunshot wound to the mouth that put a hole in the tongue, but didn't do any other damage to the teeth, to the gums, to the floor of the mouth, the very soft tissue that basically would have destroyed it if there had been enough force to blast to break the jaw. Bottom line, he said, he found blunt force trauma fractured her mandible, her jawbone, incapacitating her before she was shot. So he's saying that all of this trauma took place prior to being shot. So all these people making assumptions that this was a suicide are very unaware of the existence of the fractured mandible. That's a different injury pattern and creates a whole different scenario in the case, Anderson told Crime Watch Daily. Now, Anderson and two forensic dentists were asked to look at O'Connell's case by private investigator Clue Wright. They were kind of hesitant at first to do this, but they agreed to do this, and they agreed to do this for free, Wright said. Wright also donated his services to help the O'Connell family find even more of what he calls ignored evidence, including crime scene photos showing a bloody shirt and a gun holster, both inside the house, along with a black medical glove found on her boyfriend's car. Now, Wright said, all these items could also reopen the case. I think if those pieces of evidence were gathered that night and tested, we would not have been sitting here today, and that case would have been solved that night, Wright said. Having gotten the answers the family was looking for, Michelle O'Connell's body was returned to her grave. So they've exhumed the body. They've had other people come and look at it and make some, I don't want to say accusations, but assumptions or investigations, rather. I'm not sure the best terminology to use here. So they feel like some of their questions have been answered. So now they're going to go ahead and put her back to rest.
Right. So as mentioned earlier, in 2017, the Florida Medical Examiner's Commission reprimanded doctors Hoban and Bullock after determining they had mishandled some of the components of Michelle's investigation. As a result of the discussion, the Florida Medical Examiner's Commission unanimously found probable cause that Dr. Hoban violated State Statute 406.13FS and Rule 11G-2.005DEF FAC because he maintained part of his investigative findings, amended autopsy findings, and amended death certificate at his home. Dr. Hoban violated Practice Guidelines Article 8, Maintenance of Records, by failure to have completed notes and the investigative report in the files maintained within the medical examiner's office. Dr. Bullock violated State Statute 406.13FS, Rule 11G-2.005DENF-FAC, and Practice Guidelines Article 8, by failing to have a clear policy in place to dissuade such activity, and his apparent unawareness that the file for Michelle O'Connell's death investigation housed in the medical examiner's office was incomplete. Dr. Bullock also violated State Statute 406.135FS, which states that only legal next of kin may view autopsy photos unless permission is given by allowing a staff member to provide autopsy photos to a person who was not the legal next of kin and did not have permission of the legal next of kin to view the autopsy photos. The panel decided that Dr. Hoban would be placed on a 6-month suspension and Dr. Bullock would receive 1-year probation. Now, Dr. Hoban no longer practices in Florida. The panel recommended that Dr. Bullock be issued a written reprimand and directed to enact clear policies and procedures that guarantee that all documentation related to a death investigation be kept in the medical examiner's office, and that no autopsy photographs will be provided to anyone who is not the legal next of kin or who does not have express written permission of the legal next of kin.
Now, one thing that, you know, it's kind of like in certain jobs, there's a certain format that you use to maintain documents, paperwork. And a lot of times when you get comfortable in those jobs, you go through them. Like in my job, I have to keep a lot of records and documents. But, you know, you kind of get lax and it's like, oh, that's no problem. Oh, don't worry about it. You don't have to write it down. So these things get overlooked over time. And then all it takes is one little instance where everything you've done for the last 5 years comes to light because this one case, even though you may have done it 100 times that way and it was never an issue, but now it is. And so this is the kind of probably the scenario that they found themselves in, is this is probably something that not only happened in this case, probably happened in multiple cases, but this one was really evident.
This is what brought it to light.
Exactly. So I only say that only because there's probably more of this, and I don't want to point fingers at Hoban and Bullock. I mean, obviously they really messed up in this case, but I don't want to point fingers at them like it was any of this was their fault. The way it was handled was obviously their fault, but it could have just been the way they've been doing it for years. So I just want to put that out there because this has nothing to do with them. This has a lot to do with Jeremy Banks and what transpired between him and Michelle. So anyway. I just want to get my 2 cents in there because Lauren did a lot of legal mumbo jumbo, and I just wanted to kind of save my part, make it sound like I really know what I'm talking about.
Right.
So, you want to take another quick break and then we'll come back and
Do you think we need another break or do you want to just plow right through?
You want to just go?
Let's just go.
Let's go. Forget the breaks. Probably just a condom commercial anyway. Okay. So let's just go ahead and let's just back up because we talked about the ad break there. Let's do a little catch up. Sheriff David Shore had also asked that the FDLE come in and investigate the case. Now, investigator Rusty Rogers was assigned to the case and found some new information, witnesses, and enough evidence to have the original medical examiner, as we spoke about, Dr. Hoban, change the manner of Michelle's death to homicide instead of suicide. That's a huge step.
Yes.
That's huge.
Yes.
To have that overturned. Now, then we learned that both medical examiners who worked on Michelle's case were a little shady, if not incompetent. But because the O'Connell family and a Florida Department of Law Enforcement agent still questioned the findings, then Governor Rick Scott twice appointed a special prosecutor to review the case. And in 2012, it was Brad King of the Florida's Fifth Circuit who did not find enough evidence to conclude that a homicide occurred. But in 2015, Orange County State Attorney Jeff Ashton found not enough evidence to prosecute the case. You'll probably recognize the name Jeff Ashton, as he was the prosecuting attorney for Casey Anthony. Now, this is the guy who couldn't even get Casey Anthony convicted. Of course, he's not going to be able to handle prosecuting Michelle's case. I mean, I'm just saying.
Just saying.
Yeah, so now FDLE then asked for a special inquest into the death, saying significant questions remained. So there's plenty out there that we still don't know. So let's take it at a look. Let's ask some more questions. Now, Shore struck back in support of his officer, prompting an extraordinary conflict between two powerful law enforcement agencies. The sheriff's office told 2020 in a statement that, quote, this case has been extensively reviewed by numerous investigations who have continually ruled the death a suicide. But then a judge found that FDLE agent Rusty Rogers had probable cause to detain Banks for homicide and dismiss Banks' civil lawsuit in Rogers' favor.
Remember earlier we said that Jeremy Banks filed a civil suit against the FDLE and Rusty Rogers saying that they detained him.
Yeah, they tried to file a bogus lawsuit against Rogers for violating his civil rights by detaining.
Well, now that's been thrown out.
Exactly.
After Banks' civil suit was dismissed, the O'Connell family pushed then-Florida Governor Rick Scott to assign a new special prosecutor to Michelle's case, but Scott didn't appoint one before his term ended. ABC News' request for comment from current Florida Governor Ron DeSantis were referred to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, which said, in this case, multiple state attorneys looked at the case and determined there was insufficient evidence to pursue charges. Our case closed. But the O'Connell family is determined to keep fighting.
I don't blame them.
You can't grieve until you get justice, Patty O'Connell said. This is Michelle's mother. You have to have your justice, and it never goes away.
And to this day, Jeremy Banks has maintained his innocence and has never been charged with any crime at all. And recent reports have indicated that he still works for the St. John County Sheriff's Office as a deputy.
So in a completely not unrelated, but just strange twist, a man who took an interest in Michelle's case and started his own investigation into Michelle's death was murdered in 2019.
Huh?
On the morning of January 31st, 2019, the teenage son of Eli Washtalk, 38, discovered his father shot to death in their La Terra Condominiums residence in World Golf Village, St. John's County. Side note, right after Washtalk's death, there was confusion over his identity after detectives learned he legally changed his name to Eli Washtalk. So Eli, Eli are one and the same. But everyone close to him has always known him as either Eli, his birth name, or Craig, which his family calls him. He was a mechanic and a father of two. Authorities previously described Washtalk as a private citizen who was researching the O'Connell case, which has been a source of controversy for years, obviously. Eli apparently had binders full of information about Michelle's case in his condo. Also, something to note, even though Washtalk's death occurred in St. John's County, the Putnam County Sheriff's Office was asked to take over the investigation to avoid a potential conflict of interest because of the St. John's County Sheriff's Office involvement in the O'Connell case. That's what should have happened.
Exactly.
In 2010.
Exactly.
For similar reasons, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement declined to help preserve and process the shooting scene, according to an FDLE spokesperson. Washtalk reportedly had been in contact with Michelle's family and had grown close with Michelle's mother, Patty, as he investigated her daughter's death. Patty believes he was targeted as a result of his research. When she learned of Eli's death, Patty said, "I was petrified. I was shaken." Washtalk was intrigued because he didn't think Michelle killed herself. Eli's father believes this as well. He said, "I think if he wasn't looking into that, or if he weren't involved with that or whatever, yeah, I think he would still be alive. That's my gut feeling."
So they feel strongly that this guy got involved.
He got super involved.
And then he was, maybe he stumbled onto something he shouldn't have, rather, or maybe he was putting stuff out there. We don't know what transpired. I mean, he may have sent text messages or emails or something to other people to which this may have sort of, I don't know, formed into something just, to where they got
it's
angry.
It's just really, really convenient.
But they still don't know how he died.
He was shot.
But I'm saying they don't know. I'm saying what they don't know who shot him.
No, they don't. It is exactly. An unsolved case.
That's what I was getting at.
About 6 months before Eli's murder, he had put in a public records request for the crime scene photos and other documents in Michelle's case. According to his sister, Eli believed he was being watched and followed. On the night of the murder, Eli had actually put his teenage son in a different condo on a lower floor because he knew something terrible was going to happen. Since the murder occurred, no arrests have been made and authorities have named no suspects. They stated that they had a person of interest, but not enough to elevate that person to a suspect. Beyond that, leads have been scarce to come by.
So this is a scenario where someone has been murdered and they have no idea, just unsolved?
Yes.
Okay.
The Putnam County Sheriff's Office is asking anyone with information to contact Crime Stoppers at 1-888-277-8477.
Wow, that little tidbit there is kind of mind-boggling.
It is.
Yeah, this person decides he wants to take over a case and investigate, but he feels like Maybe there was something
but
that
he's
he
just
was
a
followed.
Citizen sleuth. I mean, like, he's not law enforcement.
Well, keep this as a note to a lot of the people that get on Reddit and the internet web sleuths that like to really go after cases. And I've heard of scenarios where people send emails out to who they think are suspects and going after these people. Be real careful, because sometimes you really don't know who you're dealing with.
Right.
And if you think that this person may be a murderer, it's probably best if you leave them alone.
Probably best if you just contact law enforcement and tell them what you know.
Exactly.
Or what you think.
I agree. Or you can call Crime Stoppers, like Lauren said, at 1-888-277-8477. So, Lauren, is there anything else you want to add to this case? I mean, this is what I said about a mysterious case. It's mysterious in the fact that no one can determine whether it's suicide or homicide. Even the sheriff's office does not know. It's really – I hate cases like this because you don't know which way to lean. And being in the true crime genre, we kind of want to lean more towards it was a homicide. But in some cases, I suppose it could have been a suicide. But I'm not really seeing anything in this case that adds up to what I would consider a suicide material. But then again, there's never an explanation for that.
Right. It's very hard. And I did a lot of research on this case. And my personal opinion, this is just Lauren from Paradise After Dark, I don't believe it was a suicide. I believe it was a homicide.
I'm going to agree with you.
And I can't say that I know what should or will happen. I hope that there will eventually somehow be justice. I think the O'Connell family has really taken it as far as they could possibly take it, which is unfortunate. I hate to see them stuck between a rock and a hard place, but I feel like that might be where they are.
We see this in a lot of
victims'
families.
Yeah, I just don't – I don't really know what to say. It's just really unfortunate. It's very sad. This was a mother. Now her daughter is 14, 15 years old. She's lived most of her life without her mom. And it's very sad. And I'd love to know what happens, and if somebody needs to be prosecuted, I hope that they are eventually at some point.
Yeah.
And if they aren't, I do fully believe in karma.
Yep, karma will get you.
So,
karma will get you.
That's
so,
all I have about the Michelle O'Connell case.
Okay, so I guess that's going to wrap us up for tonight. Again, that's Michelle O'Connell case. Look into it, and you know. Hit us up and let us know what you think. We're always available on social
please.
Media.
If anyone has anything to say, any ideas, hit us up. We are paradiseafterdarkpodcast@gmail.com. You can reach out to us on all of our social medias. And again, if you'd like to support the show, please subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/palmahawkmedia. That's PALMAHAWK Media.
And check out our website for links to all of our social media, like Lauren was talking about, our Patreon, merch store, and much, much more. And we would like to also thank everyone tonight for listening
to Paradise After Dark.
Dark, 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 dark.